Welcome to today's program, titled Simple Measures for Protecting Intellectual Property and Trade Secrets. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left-hand corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation. That will be required on all CLE attendance affirmation forms. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I would like to turn the program over to Mr. Mafo. You may begin.
Thank you. This is Simple Measures for Protecting Intellectual Property and Trade Secrets. My name is Patrick Mafo, and I'm here with Kevin Mahoney. You'll see there is a place to enter some questions. We will have a short Q&A at the end, so feel free to ask any questions you have, and we can address them at the time. A quick legal disclaimer, this presentation has been prepared by Cyphar Shaw LLP for informational purposes only. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general informational purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. So who are we? My name is Patrick Mafo. As I mentioned, I'm a partner in the Intellectual Property Department here in the Chicago office of Cyphar Shaw. I practice in the patent, trademark, and copyright areas, and I do patent prosecution and trademark prosecution, as well as litigation, counseling, transactional work, and that sort of thing.
My name is Kevin Mahoney. I'm a senior associate in Cyphar's Chicago office in the commercial litigation group. And I specialize in the protection of trade secrets, both through prosecution of trade secret actions against people who are accused of misappropriating trade secrets, as well as the defense of those individuals and companies.
And so the purpose of this webinar is really to provide a basic overview of intellectual property and trade secrets. And we've seen many companies that have a sophisticated IP and trade secret lawyers, where others within the company are involved with IP and trade secrets and may not even know it. These could be engineers or business people, or HR folks, or other in-house attorneys that may touch IP and trade secrets on an everyday basis and not fully recognize the ramifications of what they do. And so at the end of the day and at the end of this presentation, we hope that those watching this webinar will be in a better position to protect their companies IP and trade secrets based on the basic overview that we provide today. So there are various types of what I refer to as intangible assets. We usually think of patents and inventions and those sorts of things, but there are other forms of IP that others may not feel are as intuitive. A patent is pretty well known. It grants the owner limited monopoly to exclude others from, we say, making, using, or selling the invention. So patents can be on a physical product or a physical invention. Patents can be on a method of manufacture or a method of using a device or a method of using a pharmaceutical. There are various different innovations that a patent can protect. A trademark is more on the branding side of things. A trademark is a source identifier. The common one that everyone likes to use is the Coca-Cola name and logo. Coca-Cola spends a lot of money advertising its name and associating consumers with the Coca-Cola name whenever they want to buy a soda. Copyrights we conventionally thought of as protecting artistic creations, a musical album or a painting. This day and age, copyrights crop up more in software protection and the different manners of protecting software. We'll go over that a little bit later on. Trade secrets, you'll see that my colleague, Mr. Mahoney, will discuss this in more detail, and they're anything that is a secret that benefits the company. It can be a customer list or, for the Coca-Cola example, a secret recipe, any sort of process that is not publicly available, and so forth. And including the title of the webinar, in fact, is a bit of a misnomer because we say Simple Measures for Protecting Intellectual Property and Trade Secrets. And a trade secret is a form of intellectual property, but as you'll see, it's very much a different beast. So we wanted to separate trade secrets from other forms of IP just so we can provide a different overview. In this slide I put up just for fun, there are many domain names that are considered intangible assets that have been sold for quite a bit of money over the past few years. This is a non-exhaustive list of those URLs. As I mentioned earlier, patents protect inventions, and this is best suited for technical creations of the company. And I recognize companies innovate in a variety of different ways, maybe in the business operations of the company or the managerial structure of the company. Patents is more on the technical side of things. This is, as we say, where the nerds play. They're typically physical inventions relating to products that a company sells. But as I mentioned, methods of manufacturing or methods of operating can also be patented. There are various different methods of using an old innovation that can also be patented. And the patent system anywhere is not just a registration system. There are certain requirements for obtaining a patent, and as you see here, the invention must be novel or non-obvious. And to give an example of novelty and non-obviousness, I like to think of the invention of the spork. Now, the spork is a combination of a spoon and fork that is combined into one. And if I were to file a patent application today on the spork, it's obviously come out before today, so a patent examiner would then apply as what we call prior art the patent or any publication showing a spork, and I would be out of luck, would not be able to get a patent. Non-obviousness, let's pretend that the spork had not been invented yet, and I filed a patent application on the spork. The patent examiner would look at that and say, well, I can't find a spork, but guess what? I can find a spoon, and I can find a fork, and combined together, that makes a spork. And there are certain requirements that the examiner must use, legal requirements, in order to combine those two references together. The examiner can't just piece together five or six different references into one to reject the invention. There's absolutely no link between those five or six different references. But that's an issue that we run into, not obviousness, where we are trying to get a patent through the patent office, or in litigation when we're defending against a claim of infringement, you can provide prior art, more than one prior art reference combined together in order to assert that the invention would have been obvious and is therefore invalid. And there are two major types of patents that we generally run into, and those are utility and design patents. There are also plant patents. We won't cover those today. Utility patents protect the functionality of a device or a new method, and design patents protects the way that a device looks. And I'll go into more detail on those in a minute. Utility patents, as a general rule, and this is not a hard and fast rule, but utility patents are generally considered a more powerful type of patent than a design patent. The utility patent has different portions, such as the specification. That's somewhat of a long narrative portion that describes the invention, and it teaches whoever's reading the invention, the application, how to make and use the invention. There are also drawings in any patent application or any patent. Those drawings are often engineering drawings or CAD drawings that are formatted into a patent filing, or flowcharts for any process or computer software. You'll often see flowcharts. The specification and drawings, those don't themselves define the legal protection of the patent. What actually protects the invention are what are called the claims. And the claims are one-sentence summaries of what the invention is. And you'll often have more than one claim in a patent application. And now, the claim portion of the patent is only a couple pages long as compared to the much larger specification. However, we as patent attorneys typically spend about as much time on the claims of the patent as we do the rest of the patent because of how important the claims are. And as an example of that, when a patent is litigated, certain terms of the claims are interpreted. It's called claim construction. And words like essentially, or chamber, or orifice, you know, terms that may seem common in everyday language, take on a different meaning within a patent and are read differently in the context of a patent. And so it's important that we get that right up front, because there's going to be another lawyer on the other side who tries to split the hair of the patent to avoid infringement, or if we're on the defense side, we try to do that as well. So a relatively new addition to the law of patents is the first to file provision. Before priority went to the inventor who invented the invention first. So if I invented my widget first, I would get priority over someone who filed their patent application first, but who did not invent first. As you see on the chart, Kevin invented his widget before me. So under the old law, Kevin would be granted priority over the widget, even though I beat him to the patent office in the race to the patent office. And this caused a lot of problems. There were fights over who invented the invention first, and in litigation there were a lot of costs to establish the evidence that proves that person A invented before person B. And the rest of the world used a patent system that was the first to file system, so there was that inconsistency with U.S. law. We call it the metric system of patents, because in the patent world, the U.S. had the first to invent system, and the rest of the world was on first to file. Well, now it's all the same. Now it's a race to the patent office. Time is of the essence. There is more of a rush to file a patent application now than before. You would be surprised how much of a difference a couple days can really make when looking at what's come out before your application or who is granted priority. Some initial steps. With patents, we start with the inventor drafting what's called an invention disclosure. And it's important to receive the invention in the words of the inventor to determine what really is the scope of the invention and what they want to have protected. And this provides a technical explanation of the invention. The marketing folks have a very important role in this whole process, but for the invention disclosure, we really need to hear from the inventors and the technical folks to figure out how it is this thing functions. An invention disclosure can be formal or informal. We've received invention disclosures literally on the backs of napkins. We've received invention disclosures that are literally a PhD thesis. And so any formal or informal way of describing the invention is suitable. And you should ask your patent attorney what they like. For me personally, I like to know what is the problem solved by the invention and how does the invention solve it. And I feel in communicating the invention to the patent attorney, that's a great way to explain the benefits of the invention and how to best get it patented. Another optional initial step is, prior to filing a patent application, we can sometimes search for anything that has come out already that may prevent patentability. You're not obligated to do so. The patent examiner will perform their own search anyway, so if you don't perform a search, it's not fatal to the filing of the patent application. Some people don't want to jump head in and want to know if there is something out there that would prevent them from obtaining patent protection. Other people want to take a step and want to know what's out there so they know how to craft their patent to get around any prior inventions that are published. It's no one-size-fits-all approach. Many people like patentability searches, many people don't. A completely separate search would be for patents that may be infringed. So far, we've discussed obtaining patent protection, or what I call offensive patent law, but we also need to know if the product is stepping on anyone's toes when it comes out, what I call defensive patent law. And if we see a problem patent, we often work with companies before the product launches to design their product so it does not infringe any of the patent's claims, but where the design around still has all the functionality of the original design. And that's perfectly legal to do. It's perfectly ethical to do. There's nothing nefarious about that. And in fact, the patent laws encouraged the design around. The patent laws explicitly state the purpose is to teach inventors what inventions are out there and to encourage the inventors to further innovating around the patents. And so that's a very common step that we take prior to a product launch to make sure that there aren't any lawsuits coming down the pike. There are two various different forms of utility patent applications. One is a provisional, the other is a non-provisional. Some people on the line may be familiar with these terms. The provisional application is used to draw a line in the sand, so to speak. It establishes a filing date for all the content in the provisional application, and it is often a more informal patent application as compared to the more formal and more expensive non-provisional application. As you can see here, the non-provisional application has to be filed within a year if you want the benefit of the provisional filing date. And so the provisional gives you a year to either add bells and whistles to the invention, or if you're a startup, to raise more capital so that you can afford the non-provisional application, and various other reasons. Maybe you're coming up against a bar date or a deadline where you have to file that provisional quickly. Provisional applications can provide that benefit. The design versus utility I discussed earlier, design applications protect the way a product looks, and they're very helpful to prevent direct knockoffs of a product. Or in this day and age, industrial designers have a very firm role designing products that look good, and so many products are purchased simply because they look better than the competition. They may not even function better than the competition. And so those sorts of designs are protected by a design patent and can be very helpful for a company keeping out competitors who want to pass off their products as someone else's. So the process of prosecuting a patent application, first, the application is filed. It doesn't get examined for maybe another year, year and a half. Once examined, an examiner will issue what's called an office action that rejects the claims. Not always, but very often. And that essentially says that the patent application is too broad to get allowed. And that may seem like a bad thing. I frankly don't believe it is a bad thing. I think it's more often a good thing. The analogy I often use is when an examiner issues an office action rejecting the claims, it's like when you bid on a house and the seller denies your first offer. You don't want your first offer to be accepted, or else you may wonder whether you could have negotiated a little harder and obtained the house for a lower price. You know, here it's kind of the same thing. You want a broad patent application, and if the examiner allows the application on the first go-around, you'd scratch your head and wonder if you were greedy enough in the first instance. And having that negotiation with the patent office can also help you understand what else is out there, what the examiner considers to be the most pertinent prior art to narrow your claims around, and can help you obtain not only a broad patent, but one that is more likely to be considered valid at the end of the day. So after that, the examiner will issue a notice of allowance once he or she is convinced that the invention is patentable. We cut through some red tape, and the application then issues as a patent. So some helpful guidelines. I'll give a what to do and a what not to do. What to do is, even in this day and age where it's first to file, you record any activities related to the development of a product. And that can help on the second bullet with providing a detailed invention disclosure. You know, many times invention disclosures can benefit from more detail. Many times having those activities recorded, it doesn't have to be a formal notebook, but any sort of recording of the invention can be helpful for us to understand what sort of hurdles were overcome in developing this product. And then, as we discussed earlier, acting promptly is now very helpful. You know, the U.S. is now a first-to-file country, so it's become a race to the patent office. And as I mentioned, you'd be surprised. A few days can really mean a lot. What not to do is to sell or publicly disclose or offer for sale the invention prior to filing a patent application. And in the U.S., you have 1 year, you have a grace period. From the moment you sell or offer to sell or publicly disclose the invention, you have 1 year to file that application, the patent application, in the patent office. It can be either a provisional or a non-provisional, but you have a year. And in many countries, there is no grace period. And so what we try to avoid is having someone disclose the invention. There are various triggers that cause that to happen. And then a year and a day from that disclosure, try to file a patent application. Or even the next day, try to file a patent application, because then there are some countries that you would not be able to obtain patent protection on. I have some triggers here: a trade show disclosure, a negotiation with a buyer or potentially a manufacturer, any sales of the product that go through, and those would trigger the one-year clock. Other triggers are Kickstarter campaigns, and Kickstarter campaigns are problematic for a variety of reasons, but a lot of people will inadvertently disclose their invention on these Kickstarter campaigns and then try to file a patent application a year and a day from now. That can prevent you from obtaining a patent. And one other thing to watch out for those folks on the line that may be in the startup field. For employment agreements, in the patent world, it's actually fairly simple. The employee agreement, in order for the employer to obtain ownership over inventions that are created, the employer agreement should state that anything invented by the employee is owned by the employer. And there's certain language we can use to make sure that is protected. There are certain limitations on that depending on which state the employee is located in. Now, obviously, each state is different, but the common threads are listed here. The invention is made outside of working hours or without company resources, or the invention is maybe outside the employee's scope of employment. And then I list here a non-exhaustive list of states that have those kinds of laws that try to protect employees from their employers taking every last one of their innovations when it's done completely separate from their work capacity. Moving on to copyrights, and as I said, we typically always thought of copyrights as protecting artistic creations. And now we look at copyrights in the world of software and how copyrights can protect software in a variety of different ways. And the decision to protect software is a very complex one, depending on the value of the software, what the software does, how secret the source code may be. But the protection of software is a very complex one and can take the form of a trade secret, a copyright, a patent, or some combination. It can maybe be protected under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act with a more innovative procedure. But copyright protection is one form of protection for software, and it can apply to the source code, so the actual code, the letters and words written by the computer programmer, or the object code, the ones and zeros that the computer reads, or a whole host of other measures. Employment agreements in the copyright world are slightly different than in the patent world. For employees and non-employees, that's basically the difference. If you're non-employee, there must be an agreement. It's called the work made for hire provision. And as an example, if Kevin here asked me to develop a software program for him, and we didn't have an agreement that Kevin would own the copyright, I would own the copyright. And so in that area, Kevin would own the actual piece of software that I made for him, but he would not be able to install that software onto another computer. And it's different for employees. For employees, you can have an agreement, obviously, or the default is that the work must be within the employee's scope of employment in order for ownership of the copyright to flow up to the employer. And, for example, you can see in the bottom left-hand corner of the slides that Saifar Shah owns the copyright on this PowerPoint presentation. So, for example, my role as a lawyer for Saifar Shah, providing webinars such as this one, is within my scope of employment, and so Saifarth would own the copyright of this particular PowerPoint. And so this is relevant to anyone on the line who works with a third-party software developer or has software developers working for them. If they're an independent contractor, they would own the copyright in the software unless agreed otherwise. So that's something to watch out for and be careful of. At the same time, it's important to maybe delineate the scope of employment of anyone who is developing software, so that even if they are an employee, you're not relying on the law to protect you, but rather you have an affirmative agreement that states what the scope of employment is and draws a line to explain to the employee, look, this is what we're hiring you for, this is what we expect to own, so there are no misunderstandings at the end of the day. Trademarks, as I mentioned earlier, are source identifiers. And as a general rule, if it's an attribute of your company that is used to brand the company, then that attribute is likely eligible for trademark protection, or at least is worth having a conversation about whether trademark protection is available. There are limits to what you can trademark. The law firm of Sifar Shaw cannot trademark law firm. That is a generic term to define what our goods and services are. There are other limits, but the trademarks generally protect what it is that consumers use to identify themselves with your company. It can be a word or a logo. It can be the overall appearance of a design. It can be a color. UPS right now owns the color brown for their particular service, and it's a specific color, but UPS has established in the minds of consumers that that color brown is associated with their particular company. And so I have here my favorite example of trademark infringement from the movie Coming to America, the burger restaurant McDowell's versus McDonald's. Everyone knows McDonald's, the very, very powerful brand. Their logo is well known in the minds of consumers. And McDowell's was a fictitious burger restaurant that came along with a similar logo with the golden arches and a similar name. And so it's in my mind, a pretty textbook case of trademark infringement, but something to consider. If there's a McDowell's out there that is imitating your company, to look at that a second time, and to protect anything that is a source identifier for your company and for which you want attached in the minds of consumers. Now I will turn it over to Kevin to describe trade secrets and provide an overview of trade secrets.
Thanks, Pat. As Pat mentioned earlier, trade secrets are generally included in the category of intellectual property. It's often lumped in with the other three types of intellectual property that Pat discussed today, and I happen to agree with Pat that it should be. It is a type of intellectual property. That being said, there are some fairly important features of trade secrets which distinguish them from the copyrights, patents, and trademarks that Pat's already discussed. And the real defining difference between trade secrets and the other forms of IP that we've talked about today is right there in the name. The defining aspect of a trade secret is that it's a secret. It's not something that is accessible to the public. It's not something that's known to your competitors. And the fact that it's not accessible to the public or your competitors is why it's valuable to your company. For all the other types of IP that Pat discussed earlier, there's some form or some process of public registration wherein that intellectual property is recognized as such by a public entity, whether that's the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office or the U.S. Copyright Office. There is no U.S. Office of Trade Secrets. There is no government entity which will officially recognize intellectual property as either a trade secret or not. You could argue that that kind of public filing would defeat the purpose because as soon as you were to apply to something or apply for recognition publicly, the information would no longer be a trade secret. There's no such thing as a secret patent. Once a patent finally is made public, it's not a secret anymore because anybody could go find that patent online. Once information is in the public sphere, it no longer qualifies as a trade secret. Pat talked a little bit earlier about Coca-Cola and the in the context of trademarks and copyrights and how that famous brand qualifies as intellectual property. Everyone knows that brand. It's not a trade secret. It's out there on every can of Coke. Everyone sees it on commercials and billboards. So it no longer qualifies as a trade secret. But the Coca-Cola formula is another matter entirely. The story that always gets told is that the exact formula for Coca-Cola is kept in a locked vault in Atlanta and that only two executives in the company know it at any given time. That formula is not patented. It is a trade secret. Coca-Cola obviously does not want to have to submit a public patent application that lays out exactly what the formula of Coke is. But it is a trade secret, and it is intellectual property nonetheless, and it's still entitled to intellectual property protection via the trade secret laws. If one of those two executives decide to let that trade secret out, that is the formula of Coke, then Coca-Cola would have a lawsuit for trade secret misappropriation. Beyond not having to publicly disclose the information, a company might decide to keep information as a trade secret, as opposed to publicly filed IP for another reason. There is no statutory lifespan on a trade secret like there is for some of the other types of intellectual property that Pat discussed. If Coca-Cola had patented the formula of Coke, then it would have been good for 20 years and probably would have, at this point, expired about 100 years ago. Because Coca-Cola made the decision to keep the formula as a trade secret, it still is entitled to intellectual trade secret protection under the trade secret laws. I don't want to suggest that there isn't any overlap between trade secrets and the types of intellectual property that Pat already talked about today, but it has to do really with the timing of when inventions are made public. If you have an invention that's in the design phase that has not been publicly released and that your competitors don't know about, then it very much qualifies as a trade secret, and it's entitled to trade secret protection up until the point where that invention is made public through the patent application process. After that point, where you've disclosed it to the public, you're dealing with a patent and an entirely different set of laws than trade secret law. So really the first step that we want to address today in determining how to protect a company's trade secrets is by figuring out whether or not information qualifies as a trade secret in the first place. Before 2016, whether or not something qualified as a trade secret was determined on a patchwork of state laws, most of which were similar, but all of which had exceptions and differences, such that whether or not a piece of information in your company qualified as a trade secret depended very much on whether it was, for example, stored in California or New York or Boston, since the laws of all three states varied quite considerably in determining whether or not something was a trade secret. That all changed last year. The federal government passed the Defend Trade Secrets Act of 2016, which now contains a uniform definition of trade secrets that you can see on the screen in front of you. As you can tell from the language of the Defend Trade Secrets Act, the definition of a trade secret is drafted to include just about every conceivable type of information, regardless of how the information is stored or what it's described as. And there's a reason for that. Whether or not something qualifies as a trade secret is determined on a purely case-by-case basis. There are no real hard and fast rules as to whether or not something is or is not a trade secret, and more often than not, it depends on how that information is used and stored by a company. Unlike the other three types of IP that Pat talked about already, where you can get a certificate, an official document stating that your invention or your design is a patent or a trademark, there's never going to be an official document stating that something in your possession is or is not a trade secret. The closest that you're going to find to that is an order from a court in a lawsuit involving a trade secret finding that it is or is not a trade secret. So the law is drafted broadly to include just about everything because it would frankly be impossible to put forth every potential scenario where a trade secret is involved into writing. Despite that, there are two common defining characteristics of a trade secret under this law. And they're listed there after the highlighted and bold if. And it's points A and B, which really boiled down to, is the information kept secret based on reasonable efforts of the holder of the trade secret? And we'll talk about what some of those reasonable efforts are in just a little bit. But has the company taken reasonable efforts to keep that information away from the public and to keep it especially out of the hands of its competitors? The second aspect is the information valuable because it's kept secret? In other words, is that information valuable to your business by virtue of the fact that the general public doesn't know about it, and in particular, that your competitors don't know about it? So what kinds of information are we talking about that can qualify as a trade secret? This is a non-exhaustive list of some of the more common types of information that qualify for trade secret protection that we see over and over again in litigation. Business methods and business processes you see on there. There's often a question as to exactly what that means. Does your company go about its business in a certain way which competitors don't know about that creates some value to your company because of the fact that your competitors don't know? There was a case a few years ago that involved the sale of medical products and medical devices to some hospitals. And the hospital system in question had a rule in place that for any orders for any devices over a certain dollar threshold, I think it was $10,000, had to be approved by a central committee, which generally slowed things down, including the order process and whether or not orders were eventually placed. A company figured out that it could break medical devices down into their separate parts and invoice them separately. So if you had a fake shoulder, instead of invoicing a $15,000 fake shoulder, which would be over the threshold, they would invoice the separate parts, the separate screws, each as individual items that fell under the threshold. And by doing that, they were able to skip the committee and get their orders placed in the hospital quicker. When a salesperson left for a competitor, the competitor soon started doing the same thing. A lawsuit resulted, and the court found that that method of doing business was a trade secret. It was something that the first company derived value from by virtue of the fact that its competitors did not know about it and didn't know how to do it. Business plans, marketing plans. Is your company planning on expanding into a new product line? Are they planning to offer a discount? Does it intend to try to buy a competitor in a certain area? All of these things are, or they can be at least, trade secret information if it's something that your company keeps secret and keeps away from its competitors. Customer lists and pricing lists are probably some of the more common types of trade secret information that ends up in litigation. Sometimes that's public, sometimes that's not, especially in the case of a pricing list. You may have the prices of your products available on your website. But if you offer, for example, a discount to a certain customer, and if your competitors would find some value in knowing exactly what sort of discount you're offering to your customers, then that information can qualify as a trade secret. And if somebody shares that with a competitor, then there can be a lawsuit as a result. Patterns, drawings, designs, computer code. Again, these are all types of intellectual property that might end up being the subject of a patent, a copyright, or a trademark, like Pat discussed earlier. But up until the point where those inventions are made public, either through the patent filing process or, like Pat said, putting on a Kickstarter campaign or something like that, as long as they're still within your company and not being shared, they can qualify as trade secrets and they're entitled to trade secret protection. Vendor information is something that comes up in a lot of litigation as well. And you might be thinking, well, if I have a vendor who's offering their products for sale in the public, how could that possibly be confidential or trade secret information? Take, for example, a case where you have a particular vendor that sells you an item that you use in your manufacturing process. And for whatever reason, this vendor doesn't advertise. He only offers products to a set number of customers, doesn't advertise broadly, and he's offering a great price that your competitors don't know about. The fact that your company buys from that vendor, again, as long as you keep that information secret and it's not known to the general public, that can qualify for trade secret protection as well. So this is a non-exhaustive list of the types of information that can qualify as a trade secret. What generally is not a trade secret? As I mentioned before, publicly available information, information that's out there for anybody to see, is generally not a trade secret. And the question is often asked, especially in the context of a customer list, well, isn't that information public, for example, through the phone book or through the internet? If I wanted to know what a customer's name was or what their phone number was or who I needed to contact, isn't that information fairly easily available if I were to just go open up the phone book? And the answer is whether or not something is a trade secret, especially in the context of customer lists, depends in large part on how that information is organized and how that information is used by your company. Yes, the name of a company and its corresponding phone number might be available through the phone book, but whether or not that company buys products from you or whether or not that company is in the market for a certain type of product obviously isn't available. If you have a list of the customers that you commonly sell to, especially if that list is paired with, for example, the types of orders that the customer has placed in the past, what types of products that the customer might be looking for in the future, that is more often than not certainly entitled to trade secret protection. Trivial information which provides no value, generally not a trade secret. And again, there is a tendency in some cases to go overboard and call everything a trade secret, but if it's information that, even though your company might keep it secret, you really derive no economic value from it, then it does not qualify as a trade secret. There was another case a few years ago that involved a company that put a wax seal on all of its products when it left the factory, and it bought the wax from a vendor. The vendor offered to ship the wax in two different forms. You could buy it as bars, almost shaped like gold bars that you would see in the vault of a bank, or you could buy it in cubes. This company preferred the former, and they claimed that the fact that they bought their wax in bars was a trade secret. It was a preference that they had. The court, noting that all of the wax was melted down at the end of the day, found that that's not a trade secret. Despite the fact that they kept it secret, there was no economic value derived from the fact that they bought this wax in one form as opposed to another at the end of the day. Especially in the context of departing employees, the question often comes up, what about information that is memorized? If somebody has in their mind, because they've been working with customers for a long time, the name of customers and what they order, if that information only exists in their memory, is that really a trade secret, and can't they take that anywhere else? The answer is generally yes. Information which is memorized, regardless of whether it's written down or not anywhere else, generally qualifies as a trade secret. If you have an employee who manages to memorize your entire customer list and what sales those customers had in the past year, that employee cannot divulge that information to a competitor just because they didn't write it down on their way out the door. As you can imagine, otherwise, individuals with photographic memories become extremely valuable employees for that very reason. There's one more item of information not up here that does not qualify as a trade secret, and it kind of goes hand-in-hand with the Coca-Cola formula that we discussed earlier, and it's a little bit of a difference from the patent law that Pat discussed earlier. If somebody managed to reverse engineer the exact formula of Coke, that would not be a trade secret violation. While the formula of Coca-Cola isn't out there, Coca-Cola very much is. So if somebody were to take a can of Coke and take it to the lab and reverse engineer it, they didn't misappropriate a trade secret. They just figured it out on their own. And that's a fairly significant difference from the patent law that Pat talked about earlier. If somebody manages to invent something completely on their own with no reference to any prior inventions and they just happen to figure it out on their own, and they go to market with it, that's still a patent violation. It doesn't matter whether or not they discovered it independently or looked at another patent. That is not the case for trade secrets. If somebody develops information in their business that some other company happened to already keep secret, but the second company developed it independently, there has not been a violation of the trade secret law because there has been no misappropriation of the trade secret. There is one item of information which is not a trade secret that we probably see most often, and it's information that would otherwise qualify as a trade secret, but is found not to be because the company did not take sufficient steps to keep that information secret, or did not have reasonable efforts to keep that information out of the hands of its competitors. So what kind of reasonable efforts do courts often focus on when they're looking at whether or not a company took steps to keep its trade secret information secret? And again, this is a non-exhaustive list, but again and again in cases, we see these same questions asked. Is access to the trade secret information restricted to only those employees who need to access it? If you're a large company and you have an extremely sensitive document that lays out exactly who your customers are, their contact information, and what they buy, and if that document is kept on a shared drive that's accessible to everybody in the company, even those employees would have no earthly reason to look at it, then you're going to be facing an uphill battle convincing a court that you took reasonable steps to protect that information. For the employees who do have access to the information, do they sign confidentiality agreements before having access to those materials? In a lot of situations, we'll find that an employee starts at a company, a year later, somebody realizes there was a problem with HR and they never actually signed their confidentiality agreement, and that they've been exposed to confidential information without a contract for over a year. That is a problem. It is important that if an employee is going to be exposed to confidential information and they're going to be signing a confidentiality agreement, that they sign those agreements before they have access to the information. By the same token, whether or not an employee has a reason to think that material is confidential is also something that courts look to. So is material marked as confidential? And I don't mean to suggest that every document in your business or every piece of paper that contains potentially sensitive information needs to have a confidential stamp on it. But certainly, with the example I gave earlier, if there's a particularly sensitive document that you know is kept in your business, it may be worth the time to get a confidential stamp and start stamping those documents so that there's not as much of a dispute as to whether or not employees had a reason to think that that material was confidential. By the same token, if there is confidential information, your employees need to be instructed that it's not something that gets openly discussed around third parties. It shouldn't be shared with their friends. It should not necessarily be shared with customers in every situation. I know that often gets difficult where employees are told that they can't specifically share information with customers, but if an employee is sharing with a customer discounts for other customers, for example, or pricing information that are available to other customers or pricing information from vendors, then it's going to be difficult to convince a court that that information was kept confidential by the company. Is there a written company policy laying out exactly what is confidential information and what the expectations are of the employee with regards to protecting that confidential information? Even if there's not a full confidentiality agreement, which we'll talk about in just a bit, there still could be a handbook that employees are required to acknowledge, accepting, and reading that lays out exactly what their responsibilities are with regards to the treatment of the company's confidential information. And finally, and especially, we seem to be running into this a lot more, with the ability of employees to work remotely, are company documents that are sensitive accessible remotely, and are there restrictions on that remote access? This goes the same for home computers as it does for cell phones on which emails might go from the company. Does the company take steps to ensure that if an employee is able to access those documents remotely, for example, their home computer needs to be password protected, or their password requirements for the cell phone that can be used to access confidential information? Again, none of this is an exhaustive list. I'm not saying that if these procedures are not in place that you're absolutely not going to be entitled to trade secret protection, but they're all issues that courts have tended to look at in questioning whether or not an employer has taken reasonable steps and reasonable efforts to protect those trade secrets. I spoke a minute ago about confidentiality agreements, and often we see some confusion in the sense that confidentiality agreements and non-competes and non-solicits all tend to be conflated. And a lot of times, an employment agreement will contain all three of those provisions in one document, but that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. There's a mention on here of the secret of a great sandwich. There was a case last year where a certain sandwich maker with locations throughout Illinois was having all of its employees, from the CEO on down to the 17-year-old kid making sandwiches, sign two-year non-compete agreements so that they could not go make sandwiches anywhere else. The Illinois Attorney General got involved and found that that was not a good faith effort on behalf of the company to have non-competes in place for employees that really were not properly restricted. Often we hear from employers that they have employees who may be exposed to confidential information, for example, secretarial staff, who it would not be appropriate to have those individuals under a non-compete or a non-solicitation agreement. That does not mean they can't be under a confidentiality agreement. Confidentiality agreements aren't required to be in place along with non-competes or non-solicitations. You can have a standalone confidentiality agreement. And in fact, we often recommend that if an employee is not going to be subject to a non-compete, despite that, if they're exposed to confidential information, then they should really have a written confidentiality agreement in place before they're exposed to that confidential information. Unlike non-competes and non-solicits, for which there's a fairly hard and fast rule as to how long those restricted periods can last for, there's no time frame on a confidentiality agreement. If an employee is exposed to confidential information, they can be prohibited from disclosing that information for as long as it exists. There is no sunset provision on there. The Defend Trade Secrets Act of 2016 that I spoke about earlier also implemented some fairly important changes with regards to language that is now required to be included in confidentiality agreements, allowing a whistleblower exception for employees who disclose confidential information in a whistleblower lawsuit. If you've got an agreement that is prior to 2016, if you're the employer, it's probably time to revisit those agreements. It doesn't make them unenforceable if it doesn't have this whistleblower language in them, but it does create an issue as to whether or not you can recover attorney's fees in a lawsuit based on those confidential agreements. So if you have a pre-2016 agreement and have not done so yet, now is probably the time to revisit that standard form agreement and insert the whistleblower language if it's not already in there. To go through all of trade secret litigation would be another hour-long presentation, but I did want to give a brief overview because, as I mentioned earlier, there is no registration process. The only way to determine whether or not, as an official matter, something is a trade secret or not is to have it determined by a court of law. In any lawsuit that involves a trade secret, speed matters. If you come to your lawyer and say that a competitor has one of our trade secrets and they've been using it, and the attorney asks you for how long, and you say 18 months, then right off the bat you're going to have a very difficult case to prove, because courts have found that as part of the required reasonable efforts to protect a trade secret, litigation is included, such that if a company knows that its trade secrets are being misappropriated and sleeps on its legal rights, courts have found later that that was essentially relinquishing that trade secret because they didn't do anything to protect it. So if you have any indication that your trade secrets have been misappropriated or that they're being used by a competitor, it's important that you speak to an attorney as quickly as possible to determine whether or not a lawsuit is an appropriate measure. In conjunction with that, I think the average lawsuit right now in Cook County Circuit Court is up to about 3 years. Lawsuits go on for a while, but trade secret matters are usually determined within the first 2 months through what we call the preliminary injunction process. In almost every trade secret matter, there is a motion for preliminary injunction filed alongside the complaint, which asks the court for more or less an expedited trial on the merits of whether or not a trade secret is being misappropriated or used and whether or not it needs to be returned immediately. Often it's the make or break point of the case. So we've had situations in the past where we go to file a motion for preliminary injunction. We ask the company to identify an individual who's going to be able to testify at that hearing, who has information about the trade secret which was misappropriated. And the answer we hear is that the only individual who knew about it is the employee that we're suing. You don't need to have all the steps in order to file a lawsuit before a lawsuit arises, but it's important that you have a general sense of, if we find out that a trade secret has been misappropriated, who is the individual who's going to testify on our behalf? Who is the person who knows the most about what those trade secrets are and what they mean to our company? Because that's the individual who's going to be signing the affidavit that's attached to your preliminary injunction motion. By the same token, we've gotten into situations where we ask the company to define, well, exactly what trade secrets information has been taken, and the answer is, well, it's all of our business. It's everything about our business. It's tough to get an injunction when you're unable to define exactly what the information is that's been taken. So it is important that you have somebody who's able to define with at least a little bit of specificity exactly what the information is and exactly what it means to your company. I didn't put it on this slide because it's often a last resort and doesn't come up in a lot of these civil cases, but there is an overlap between criminal law and trade secret civil law, such that if a trade secret has been misappropriated, in certain cases, there could be the involvement of criminal authorities. Again, doesn't come up very often. We would not suggest that if you think a trade secret has been misappropriated that your first call is to the FBI. You should call your attorneys first, but it's important to note that, especially in certain technical products, I can think for an example, there was a lawsuit a few years ago where somebody was alleged to have stolen the formula of Kevlar from DuPont. That was a case where the individual was arrested by the FBI on his way out of the country. So again, if you think that a trade secret has been misappropriated, either by a former departing employee or a competitor or through some other means, don't call the FBI right away, but do call your attorney, and it's important that you do so as quickly as possible. With that being said, it looks like we have about 5 minutes left. We're going to open up the line to any questions, and at this point, I'm also going to mention the CLE code for those who need it, is SS, as in Sam, 2216. That's SS, both as in Sam, 2216. Thanks very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will conduct the question and answer session. To ask a question via the web presentation, select the chat pod located in the lower left-hand corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. And we are now ready to begin. And our first question reads, is a trade secret a type of proprietary information, or is proprietary information a type of trade secret?
The answer is both, and frankly, those terms are used almost interchangeably. So proprietary information generally in a legal sense means information which is known to the, it's property. It's property of the company which is not known outside of the company. That's a trade secret. So I could almost say that you could use those two terms interchangeably to talk about a trade secret.
We have another question. If you reverse engineer something that is a trade secret, can you patent it at that point? And the answer is no, for a variety of reasons. If you reverse engineer something that is a trade secret, first of all, you didn't at that point invent it. There may be some inventive components behind your reverse engineering that could be the subject of patentability, but if you're not the inventor, you can't patent something that is not your invention. Another issue is that if the trade secret, let's say Coca-Cola, the recipe for Coca-Cola, if I reverse engineer the recipe for Coca-Cola and try to patent that recipe, you know, Coca-Cola has already been sold for more than 1 year and sold for hundreds of years. And so the patent examiner would say, Coca-Cola has already been sold. You are now trying to obtain a patent on something that has been sold for more than 1 year. And so because of that, we cannot grant you a patent on this particular invention. With a lot of reverse engineering, there are components to that, maybe the process of the reverse engineering, that then becomes more innovative and more likely to be patented. But strictly reverse engineering something that has been sold for more than a year is likely not going to be the subject of patentability.
Thank you very much. Our next question reads, if we already employ engineers, can we now make them sign a document that says anything they invent belongs to the company, even if we did not make them sign it at the time of employment?
The answer to that is yes. You know, if employment agreement, any agreement has what's called consideration, meaning what is the bargain for value of entering into that contract? And for an employee, many times to enter into a contract, the benefit is to have a job. And to then sit down with the employee and say, well, you know, we're now going to revisit our continued agreement, and our agreement now states that you're now employed for this company, and in order to maintain your employment, we want you to agree that anything you invent within the scope of your employment within this company is now owned by the company. And that becomes even a clearer picture when the employee is, for example, an engineer or something along those lines.
And I should mention in conjunction with that, it used to be the case in Illinois, and this is in regards to non-compete agreements, that if you had an employee who was not under a non-compete, but you wanted to put them under a non-compete, the only consideration that Pat just mentioned that you needed to give them was continued employment. At least in Illinois, that is no longer the case. If you now want to put an existing employee under a non-compete, there needs to be some new consideration that you give them beyond continued employment. That may be the case as well for a new agreement that specifically says any inventions from this point out are the property of the company. That may require some new consideration as well, beyond just saying, well, we're going to keep you on as an employee if you sign this.
That concludes our question and answer session at this time. This concludes today's webinar. We want to thank our speakers and thank all of our participants for attending.